Hi, Joe. Hi, Joe. What's up, sexy beast? How are you?
I'm good. Good. How's life in the wilderness? Still good?
Still good. Ate shit again on my mountain bike. You know, I got this one here.
Let's just be clear. When you say you ate shit, that means that you fell.
Yeah. I fell. I mean, I think people would understand it. I didn't actually eat shit, like physically eat shit in my mouth. I fell on my mountain bike, you know. But it was a great day. I cleared all the jumps that I wanted to clear. And then with 200 yards left in my entire day, my pedal hit the fucking ground, dug into the dirt, and I went flying. Hit my head, you know, bruised up my side, but getting back out there tomorrow, Joseph. It's just what I do.
You're like a much more poor Simon Cowell.
Why is that?
Because he just was testing out an e-bike. You didn't see that headline?
He
crashed in his courtyard, which I'm sure his people made certain was in the report that he has a courtyard. And that he went immediately into back surgery. They put a rod in his back. And I guess he's going to be okay. But I saw an old interview that it linked with where he said he got fit because he got into biking. And he said that he's lost 60 pounds. That's
wow.
That's absurd. He wasn't 60 pounds heavier than he is now. That's not possible.
I haven't seen him lately.
Well, I mean, he looks fit. He looks more fit, but he wasn't 60 pounds heavier at one point.
But here's the thing. Why are you buying an e-bike, you know, if you're trying to lose weight? I mean, it's basically a motorcycle, you know? I mean,
yeah,
you're not getting that much exercise on an e-bike.
An e-bike is a bike that you can pedal when you want to pedal and just turn on and zoom when you...
Okay. Yeah, you can switch different gears and it's pedal assist. You know, but I don't do that. I like to mountain bike up and get some kind of a workout.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
So you're falling all the time. You're hungover. I'm
hungover today. I had a barbecue with some friends out here, and you know, I drank a little too much. I smoked some marijuana, and then I actually had some chocolate mushrooms too. So I woke up feeling a little hazy, you know what I mean?
Do you remember our conversation with Danny Trejo at all?
Who's Danny Trejo?
Okay, that's my point.
Of course I do. Of course
he was talking about being eight and learning how to roll joints and whatever. I could sense you salivating on the other side of the Zoom call.
No,
and he was doing it as a cautionary tale.
I know, but I did want to ask him, and I forgot to, just about how weed is legal now and how he felt about that, you know. I'm sure he would say it was bad, but it's not. So
it's not. Well, that's your 2 cents.
No, it is. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 cents. But it was fun. I had a good time. I got a new barbecue called the Big Green Egg.
Oh, I've seen those.
It's fucking fantastic. It's so cool. It is amazing. Although I had quite the time trying to light this motherfucker. It took forever and ever. I couldn't figure it out. So there's a learning curve, but I'm excited about it.
Who'd you have over? Who were your friends?
I'm a friend, Brian first, Esty, you know, and then we keep it small. And then, you know, my parents, it was small. Everything is reduced in size now because of the corona. So,
but do you feel the need, like I do, even when you're describing a party that you had, to give the disclaimer that it was COVID friendly? And
yes, that's why I sort of did that. You know, actually, this family got tested, you know, before they came even up to Colorado, and then they even got tested before they came to my house for the barbecue because they were just, you know, concerned out of out of just extra caution.
Yeah, that, nobody like, wants know, to be the couple that kills Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. That's the exactly. only reason. It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with Aaron. Nobody wants to be indicted on some manslaughter charge of taking down America's first entertainment couple.
It's true. It's true. It's a nice buffer that I have, because then I know that if they're coming to my house, everyone's going to be safe, because they do fear killing Hollywood's oldest couple.
Yeah.
Been together 37 years and still going strong.
God, 37 years.
I know. How are you, dude? What's happening? How was your week?
Week was good. We're just doing our day-by-day thing here at home. The boys are getting to a fun age where they're really opening up even more and showing more personality. And Wyatt, who's the more verbal one, is now making fun of his brother's shortcomings in the language department. It was kind of sad. Blake this morning was trying to say, we watched the, what does the fox say? Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. We watched that last night. And Blake was trying to say, I want to watch the What Does the Fox Say video, but he kept saying fox face, fox face. And Wyatt turned to him and went, fox face? What is that? Like, you just lay off. You're two, he's two, shut up. I can, you know, you're not so smart, even though he's probably smarter than I am. And as you saw them up close at your house.
Just unbelievably cute. So different, though. Just such different personalities.
It's incredible.
It's so funny. I mean, that's the crazy shit, you know, that you discover more and more as your kids even get older and older, how different they all are. It's really crazy to me that they all came from myself and Aaron, but they're all different little beings. They've got their own quirks. You know, Bodhi couldn't be more different from Wilder, but there is a common thread that binds them all together. And for us, I think that's humor. Their sense of humors are in sync.
Yeah.
Very much so.
That stuff, I think, is, I think the overall behavior is baked in to the DNA, but I think the humor is something that can be developed by mom and dad, and then surroundings, and your aunts and uncles and whoever's around them. And then they get a sense of what's funny, what's not, what's stupid, what's
totally. But you're right. I think you're right. It does come from the top, meaning parents first, because they grow up listening to you and dealing with you and, you know, trying to understand, associating with your sense of humor. You know, my kids, you can't get anything by them now. I mean, even at the age of 7, Rio, because I have fucked with them so much.
Yeah.
As little
so
babies,
good.
Meaning like teasing them or trying to trick them,
yes.
You know, and they were gullible for a minute, but now I can't even do it. Like my kids look at me like, Dad, it's not going to work anymore. Don't even try. I can't mess with them.
Well, the other
night. I've jaded them.
It doesn't stop, because the other night my 21-year-old Trudy was here and we had a great dinner. She went headed back to LA. She's going back to USC. She's there now. We're recording this on Monday. And I was giving my wife, Michelle, shit about cleaning up after she cooked this amazing dinner. She and Trudy cooked dinner for everybody. Then I'm like, Michelle, come on, let's go. These dishes aren't going to wash themselves, like joking around. But I kept doing it. And Trudy's like, God, you know, it's great when she gangs up on me with my wife, considering how that whole relationship began.
Yeah.
And now Trudy's like, I mean, how do you even put up with that? It's so annoying. It's not funny. I'm getting shredded by my kid, and my wife is throwing in with my daughter, and I'm over here like, no, it is funny because I'm enjoying it and you guys are killing time. Get back to washing the dishes.
Right. But you're the odd
man.
Stop
talking.
Out now.
But I'm the odd man out. Now I'm the jerk in the corner. And but I always treated my kids like adults. I never did the baby talk thing. I never did I treated them like they were my buddies and, you know, like Michael Strahan checking in.
Yo.
But, yo.
Yeah, this is yet another guy, Oliver, that is such a good guy. Nobody wants to hear these five words. Will you be on six words, my podcast? But no. He said yes. And he also is on vacation in the Bahamas, and he still said yes.
Wow. That's big.
Yo,
man.
Hey, I thought you were going to say nine words. Why haven't you asked me to marry you yet? Something like that.
God.
That would have really got me.
Why do you think we're doing this podcast? This Joe's going to make the announcement right now.
Yeah, you're going down, Michael. This is a setup. No, this is an intervention for you.
I've already been there. I've been there before, man.
I was going to ask you this eventually, but let's just start with this. You played in the league. You see what's going on with Major League Baseball. You know how these guys live. The idea of being choir boys and going from facility to home and doing this the best possible way is unrealistic to me. And I trying to keep this coronavirus out of the NFL where it just doesn't become outbreak city, I'm really hopeful, but man, I think it's going to be Herculean to try to get through this season. Do you agree with that?
I think it will be beyond Herculean to do it, because you hit it on the head. If you're a vet and you have a wife or you have a family or something like that, okay, you go to work, you go home, you pretty much have a routine. If you're single, or if you are a new young player who just for the first time have a little money in your hand and you just bought your gold chains and you want everybody to see you, you're not going to stay home, man. You're going to be out and about. And if you can't go out, you're going to bring the party to you. So that's what I think about. I worry more about that. It's not, guys are smart enough, at least some are, to not you know, go out and be caught at Magic City and try to sit there buying chicken wings. You know,
That was amazing, by the way. But, you know, Magic City does have great chicken wings. That's real.
I haven't gone. Oliver, I couldn't tell you if that's real or not.
I don't even know what Magic City is. What is that? It's like a strip joint, man. Or something?
Yeah, yeah, didn't you hear that story?
No, I don't know. I didn't. What? Is this NBA or what is this?
NBA. Lou Williams left the bubble to go to a funeral, but he took a picture with a rapper who then posted it saying, "You never guess where we ran into each other at," like a little thing. And they were like, "Lou Williams, he was at a funeral. Why is he hanging out with this guy?" And they were at Magic City. And Lou Williams said, "Well, I'm at Magic City because I went to pick up food for, I guess, the family," because they have great food, chicken wings. But then you had three or four girls who said, "Yeah, we danced for him while he was here." I guess that's part of waiting for your food. You get a lap dance or two.
I'm good with that. That's in other times. I'm fine with that. That seems like a nice combination of things.
Yeah.
So, Mike, you were the youngest of six. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Baby.
So you were the baby. What was it like, you know, being the baby of six? Of six kids.
Well, it was a lot different, like, when I was a kid than it is now. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, then I was like the baby. Mom, you know, I'm the one who's at the house. Everybody else is running the streets. I'm still too young. I'm kind of with my parents, probably spent more time with my dad than anybody. So that relationship with my dad has and always will be strong. And it was, my mom made me the cake. She cooked for me. She did all these things while my brothers were out there gallivanting, but it was great. It was cool. But at the same time, I would get picked on. I was getting beat up. I was getting all those things. And now I remember when I was 13 years old, I started working out because they called me Bob, which meant big old butt or booty on back. So when they started calling me Bob, I started working out. I started doing push-ups and sit-ups with Herschel Walker workout book. And I bought the Jane Fonda tape. So I was doing like Jane Fonda leg lifts and stuff, trying to work literally my ass off. And then I started working out with my dad. And when I was 15 years old, my brother Victor, who used to wrestle in high school, he started like messing with me downstairs, messing around. And I was just throwing him around the room. Like, get off, man. And that's when I realized, oh, little brother ain't so little anymore, you know? But then as I got older, now I almost in a lot of ways feel like I'm more of the older one because I'm probably the most responsible one. Mm. I'm the one who makes sure everybody's okay, you know, but the roles have kind of reversed. But it's cool, man. It's cool. It's a lot of kids when you have, you know, sick kids, a lot of kids.
Did you have a special relationship with your dad? Meaning, I'm not saying it's more special than anyone else's, but because you were the little one, you know, was there a certain bond that you guys had?
Well, I think because when I started working out, and I was just doing the push-ups, sit-ups, and Jane Fonda in front of the TV at home, my dad said, well, if you're willing to work like that, then let's go to the gym. Mm-hmm. So I worked out with my dad basically every day from 13 through 17. So that right there, I mean, it's kind of like playing sports. When you're around somebody, you sweat together, you're working out together, and they're pushing you and you're pushing them. The more my dad pushing me because he had already done his thing. He was a boxer in the Army. I mean, that builds a special bond. And I know 100% I never had a football career or anything else without my dad. My parents sent me back to Houston because I didn't play any high school football till my senior year. Mm. My dad sent me to Houston to live with my uncle to get up and say, you're going to get a football scholarship. I hadn't played football since I was a kid. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I had one scholarship. And I credit my dad with like seeing or making me see and believing in me enough to where I was able to actually make it happen.
But sometimes, Michael, that closeness comes as a result of where your dad is in his life, too. Like I think about my, you know, I'm one of eight for my dad, at least. But I came
along. Man, your parents, woo. Hopefully
well, I'm only one of two. I'm only one of two. I can't speak for the other female in my dad's life. But as I came along, he was at a time where he really wanted to be more involved, taking me on road trips, you know, really making sure that I was being raised the right way. And maybe that was the case with your dad, who was in the Army. And this was taking place, I assume, in Germany. Is that when that was going on?
Yeah. I mean, he was still in the Army when this first started. We started working out together. But I do agree with you. I think he was just at a point in his life where maybe his life was a little more settled. Yeah. And he was able to take that time to spend with me. But he was always very inclusive. He always went on fishing trips and all these things. And if the kids couldn't go, he wouldn't go. And he, you know, he was just a very inclusive dad. But my relationship with him is definitely a little bit different than with my brothers because I spent that time with him when I was from 13 to 17, like pretty much literally every day working out, hanging out. You know, I remember going back in the day, it was so easy to get your kids to do things. He would have me jog with the platoon, and I just got like one of those regular size Gatorades. And I was like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. I get a Gatorade by myself. But it was like the simple thing that kept you going.
What was it like having a dad in the Army? I mean, were you in one place or were you moving around a lot?
We were in Fort Bragg, North Carolina when we were in the States. Because my dad is with the 82nd Airborne Division, so he had to jump out of plane.
Wow.
We were in Maryland for a bit, but most of the time I remember is being at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's when I played football my first 2 years, 7 and 8 years old. I played for the Falcons and the Saints. Mm. And then we moved to Germany. And you know, that was different. That was fantastic because I really grew up in Germany, so the chance to see the world. And it gave me a different outlook to where I don't look at the world as being just like the U.S. And that's all you know. And you never left your town or you never left your state. Like I've seen a majority or a lot of the world. And it's kind of opened up my view that the world's a big place. And your thoughts and philosophies and your way of life is not the only way that people live in the world. And I think that's really, really helped me. So I'm grateful that my dad was in the military. I think it gave me discipline and structure. And on top of that, it gave me a worldview.
Yeah, when you got to the NFL, was it eye-opening to hear and feel and almost experience in some ways how teammates' childhoods were so different than yours? I mean, it's got to be what led to your post-career stuff. I mean, the football was always one thing to you, but you're like a unicorn. You do so much. You're so prepared for all this stuff. Go back to that, the initial part of that question, how different your life was as a kid than the guys that you shared a locker room with.
I'll tell you right now, was it different? Hell yeah, it was different. I mean, when I came back for high school, and that's the true story, Kirk Menefee messing with me all the time. When I came back from high school, this is how naive I was at 17. When you're in Europe, all you hear about all the bad things here, the drug problem, this and that. I get off the plane. My uncle picks me up. We ride to his house, and there's a drugstore with the big, you know, the big old sign that say drugs. I remember thinking, oh, my God, the problem's so big, they're advertising. Like, that is how.
Wow.
That is not a joke. That's how, don't say stupid, but stupidly naive I was about it. But the more time I spent here, of course, the more, you know, comfortable I got. But when you're in these locker rooms and you see, hear some of the story, the way some of these guys grew up, it gives you a better understanding of the way that they act, the way they react, the way that they kind of live their life. And I've always been a guy, football's always, it was fantastic. I mean, God, thank God for football. But at the same time, I never thought it was the only thing that I could do, because when I grew up, it wasn't the only thing I thought I would do. So when football was over, I just think having that, just feeling like, oh, that was just a part of my life, not my whole life, it allowed me to do everything that I do now. And it's funny because I was talking about you, Joe, the other day with some friends yesterday. As a matter of fact, we're watching a golf tournament, and we were talking about, you know, doing golf commentary, and then you doing baseball, and you're doing football, and you're doing all these things. People don't know, first of all, the preparation is tough, especially when you first start, when you don't know the rhythms of it. And then just to be able to just go, like, not going to say unfiltered, but just to be able to talk like that for hours. People think talking for a living is easy, but sometimes it's not. And well, you make it look effortless. For me, I'm like the king of the 1 or 2 hour job. Yeah, I go do news for 2 hours. I do a talk show for an hour. I do a game show for an hour. Then I go home.
Yeah, but you're underselling yourself. Who the hell wants to get up and read news? And I'd be so scared that I'd read something and make myself look so damn stupid on network TV in the morning with some, you know, whether it's the situation in Beirut or, you know, you mispronounce something or, you know, the workings of the government or all, you know, all that stuff. I mean, you've got so much in just hosting a game show and reading teleprompter and doing all that stuff is not easy.
Your ass off.
Yeah. Jesus. I don't know how you keep everything straight. I mean, you're pumping my tires. I'll pump yours. I don't get it. I don't see how you do all this stuff.
Well, I have fun because it's fun. To me, it's like fun job. I don't have any job that's like a weight on my soul. And like I said, you talk for a living. Used to get beat up for a living, man. And me looking across the desk at George Stephanopoulos is a lot different than me looking across the line from John Runyon. So I'm not, it's a totally different thing. But that is the one fear that I do. It's mispronouncing a name or mispronouncing something. So you got to definitely make sure. And there are certain ways that you say a word that somebody else may say it differently that really doesn't matter. But in your head, you always think, oh, I got to be wrong. So you got to make sure I'm in my producer like, hey, Aaron, do you hear me? How do you say that word? Make sure I get it right. Yeah. But to mispronounce someone's name. Oh, man, that's like one of the worst things, especially in a live interview.
Were you preparing, you know, for life after football early on? Meaning when you were working, when you were on the field, were you thinking, what is my life after this sport?
Because
you become so prolific, man. I mean, you're doing everything, literally everything. You know, did you have an idea that this is the path that you wanted to go on after football?
No, I mean, first of all, I appreciate that, but no. I mean, I was just playing football, and I'm not a fool, man. Playing in New York makes a big difference.
Yeah,
it's a big difference. If I had played in another city, I just would have been a guy who played in another city. So playing in New York gave me all these different opportunities, and I used to have fun. And they would say, "Hey, Michael, do you want to come over and you want to, you know, do this show or do that show? Why not? I'd try it, and if it were fun, I'd continue to do it. If it weren't, then I wouldn't. But I didn't look at it as a way to say, okay, this is going to be my next career. Let me set myself up. I wasn't that. I wasn't like these guys are now. Mm-hmm. These guys now have the next step in their head about what they want to do, if it's TV or if it's business or anything like that, which I take my hat off to them for thinking ahead. For me, it was almost like I fell into everything that I'm doing right now. And it happens to be stuff I never went to school for, but it's just a testament that if you're willing to work at something and put yourself out there and not be afraid to try something, then good things can happen for you. But no, I never woke up and said, yeah, you know, I want to be on TV when I'm done playing football. Happy it happened, though. I'm very happy it happened.
I was just going to say, I wish I knew you better as a player just during those years. I did a million of your games, including your Super Bowl win in Super Bowl 42, which to this day, when people go, what's the most intense game you've ever done in the NFL? That's my answer, because my heart was in my throat in that fourth quarter. It was just you guys going against the Patriots and the Patriots going for a perfect season, and Eli was damn near perfect in the postseason, and your defense was rolling. But I wish I knew you better back then so I could compare you then to now. But if I did, would I see the same guy? Has there been any sort of evolution personality wise that I would go, yeah, but back then he was
a total dick.
Well, not a dick, but you got to be kind of a dick. You got to kind of be a dick.
I'll tell you this, though. It's funny. First of all, if your heart was in your throat, where do you think my heart was? But you didn't, personality wise, off the field, same. On the field, and when it came to work, I was an ass, man. Like, I was an asshole. This is what we do. Like, this is no joke to me. I'm not out here just playing. When you're young, you're out there playing because you want to make money. You want to make money. You want to get, you know, you think, oh, I want to be famous and the girls and all these different things. But then when you get older, it's like, I'm out here playing because I want to win. And the best thing I ever did, which I wish these young guys would do, is I used to get my Super Bowl tickets every year and I'd give them away. I wouldn't even go. And then I went to see the Patriots when the first Super Bowl Brady won against the Rams. Was it the Rams?
Yeah, 01.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I went to that. The first Super Bowl game, I actually went, used my tickets to go to a game. And when that confetti fell, those guys ran out there, I was like, damn, this is what you play for. This is what you play for. So that's when my focus went from, you know what, I'm out here making money and doing my thing, to, man, you know what? I want to win. I want to win. So I was fun and cool, and I had my guys back. And if you had a problem with the coach, you come to me. I was the guy who was going to handle all that. But if you weren't going to do your job, I was going to jump your ass, because I'm not out here getting beat up to lose. I'm not here getting – I only had one time in my career that I actually, like, went to a locker room and destroyed some shit. Mm-hmm. And it was all in Seattle. Our kicker decides he wants to, you know, not really pre-kick and warm up, and goes out there and misses a field goal to help us win the game. And we end up losing the game. And instead of getting to him, I decided to take a few chairs in the locker room because I felt like at that time, man, and I kept saying to the coach, we're always the bridesmaid and never the bride. Like, we're always close. Like, enough of this closeness. We need to win. Like, screw that. Everybody wants to win, but who the hell here expects to win? And that's a different mentality. And going back to that Super Bowl, for once in my career, we didn't just want to win. We actually expected to win, and it happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about your kids? I mean, have you instilled that work ethic into your children, or is that just who they are? You know, before you got on, Joe and I were just talking, because I have three kids. He's got, you know, however many kids he has, four.
Four.
We were just talking about how different, four that you know of, Joseph.
Right.
We were talking about how different our children are. You can raise them the same, but they're just different beings. You know, I mean, do they have your work ethic for the most part?
Yes, very much so. I have four, and my oldest daughter, she is very like, she and my oldest son are very, very self-sufficient. Like, I got to ask them, are you okay? Do you need anything? What's going on? You know, and I always joke like, oh, you know, do I help them? Yeah, but it's more for me than it is for them, because I always say, oh, when are they going to get off daddy scholarship? But in the heart of hearts, heck, you know, they don't really ask for anything. And they want to do it on their own. To one point, my daughter lives out in L.A. She's a graphic designer. She graduated college out there. Went to Texas for a while. And then I thought she was going to come to New York because I had a job lined up for her there. She wanted to move back to L.A. So she's in L.A. and she's looking for a job at that point. And we're at dinner and I said, well, how's the job hunt going? Oh, you know, it's been really tough. So I think I'm going to, you know, just join up and be an Uber driver. Uber driver? Not saying anything's wrong with being an Uber driver.
But that's your baby. That's your baby girl. For God.
Exactly. Like, you're my firstborn child and you're going to be an Uber driver?
Right. Nah.
So at that point, she ended up working for me at our company out there, our office in L.A. And then in the middle of this pandemic, she's like, I'm putting in my 2-week notice. And I'm like, really? She's like, yeah, I got a job in graphic design, which is what she wanted to do, what she went to school for. So I'm proud of her. And my son, he works for us in New York, our office in New York. But you wouldn't know. They're not kids who run around and say, hey, you know, I'm this and that. And my name is this. My dad is that. Never. You would never know. They are so humble and nice, just nice people. Yeah. And then I have twins like Joe who are going to be 16 in October. And my older twin is one of the four kids who is very, like, she's chill. Like, she's the one who can say, oh, you know what? I just want to go live in the Bahamas and sit around on the beach and, you know, and just relax. Whereas her sister, the youngest, is very focused. Like, the school that they go to in New York, she got into a school. She's so happy. And it was her focus because it's like one of the highest Ivy League acceptance schools in the country. Like, she is on another level. Like, even talking to her, am I talking to my kid or am I talking to somebody else as an adult? Mm-hmm. So I got one who's, I have a feeling, maybe on daddy's scholarship longer than the others, and the other three could take care of me.
I love that, though. I love that story, though, about your daughter and Uber. That just says so much about what kind of a person she is. It's like, look, I mean, I grew up with famous parents, and I did not want anybody to know who they were. I wanted to be my own person, you know? It was a big thing for me. And when anytime anyone found out, I questioned whether they liked me for me or whether they were just trying to get to know my parents for whatever reason. But the fact that she would just say, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to go drive an Uber. I don't need you. I'm going to do this on my own. You know, what a mentality to have. She will be fine for the rest of her life, you know?
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. Like, I don't worry. Like, I'm not worried about them. When they had that attitude, I'm like, they will do anything to survive within death legal. So, you know, but for that, I was scared to hear it, but at the same time, I was happy to hear it. And you're right. I think I can't imagine growing up how you grew up in that situation with famous parents, world famous, who, I mean, how do you react when somebody comes? You have to question pretty much everybody. But as you get older, of course, you find out you can decipher between real friends and then acquaintances. Oh, yeah. And, you know, but yeah, when you're a kid, man, that's got to be a hard existence.
It sharpens you. You get sharp, you know. I mean, you have no choice. You know, you have to start to read people and you gain an intuition that I don't think I would have had. Like, I know for a fact that Joe doesn't really like me. You know, he's sort of in it.
I don't. I'm such a huge fan of Private Benjamin. I want to see. And Kurt Russell, Snake Plissken, I just want to meet them someday. If I can, then this podcast is done.
Hey, only reason I'm doing this podcast is because Overboard. I mean, I'll be honest with you.
I'll get you a signed poster.
Oh, yes, baby.
The answer for Oliver was, when you have a famous parents like that, world famous, you end up doing a podcast in your mid-40s, almost mid-40s, called Daddy Issues. So that's right. Kind of what we're talking about.
That's right.
That's his problem.
Hey, well, but isn't it something like Daddy Issues that all you want to do as a parent is to keep your kids from having any? I mean, that's my whole focus right now. Ugh.
I know. But here's the question. How long can they stay on the scholarship before they it screws them up? You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be that cutoff point, because then you start to enable. So where is that line?
But I think my kids are smart, though. My older kids are smart that they don't ask for anything. So almost forget they're like on scholarship. Mm-hmm. If they were constantly asking, I'll be like, well, damn, you already get this or every month. So like, well, why do you keep on asking? What are you doing with your money? You got to budget better. You got to do this. But the fact that they don't ask ever, I actually forgot they wanted daddy scholarship until this podcast. So now I got to go back and, you know, look
sorry,
look again
kids.
At the financials.
Kids. It's our fault. I do think though, on some level, everything that you put in when they were little, and you were molding and shaping these young people, you know, you do get that back. And if you were willing to put in that time back then, you're not going to be the dad. And as tough as Oliver tries to talk, whatever these kids need, if you're able to provide, you're going to provide. I mean, I don't feel like I'm being taken advantage of, that my 24-year-old is trying her own podcast and is trying to act. And as long as she's a good, happy, solid citizen that treats people well, how am I going to, with everything I've got and so fortunate, going to say no to her? I mean, I get it. They got to do their own thing, but sometimes their own thing that makes them happy isn't the most profitable thing that they could be doing. I mean, you got to know what they are.
So hold on. She's 24, Joe?
Yeah.
Damn. Mm-hmm. I did not know that was 24 years old.
Yes.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
But you know what? But being around her, Thursday night football, everybody loves her. She couldn't be better. And, you know, and so that's a testament to parenting, of course. And you're right. It is hard whenever you have a certain life or lifestyle. And then I don't want my kids to not in some way, shape, or form kind of benefit from it. But at the same time, I do have to remind the younger twins, okay, I just want you two to realize that this life is not your life. This is my life. The lifestyle is not your lifestyle per se. It's a byproduct of my lifestyle. So you're going to have to earn and work hard in order to keep it up in this way, shape, or form. Or you know what? It doesn't continue. Like, I just don't want you to get this false sense that this continues. But I'm also for you. I'm with you too. When it comes to this with your kids, I tell my kids, which I got this from Lionel Richie. He doesn't even remember this because I doubt he remembers this dinner thing we were at in LA. But he said, I tell my kids to use me. Use me while I'm here. Let me connect you. Let me put you in a position, if I can help you, to do the things that you want to do. Because when I'm not here anymore, that goes away. So use me while you can to get yourself in a position of where you need to be. And it goes against, you know, in a lot of ways when you're growing up, you're like, I don't want to build this to my parents. But when you become an adult, I do think of when you become of a certain age, if you can get that nudge, if mom and dad can help you, I hate to say it, but nepotism is real sometimes.
Yeah.
And it helps.
Yeah,
baby.
Yeah.
But it's like anything else, right? You can get your foot in the door. But at the end of the day, you have to prove yourself. You know, you have to prove that you can do this thing. I mean, even for me, you know, I can get an audition when I'm first starting out. But if I suck, they're not going to hire me. You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, nepotism is real. Take advantage of that. There's no reason why you shouldn't. And my parents were big on that. Just like you said, this isn't the real world. You know, we live in our world, but this isn't the real world necessarily. And you need to understand that. And they always made me work for the things that I got. I never got allowance. I never was just floated money ever. You know, I went to college and I got a credit card in college, which everyone does. And I was $300 over. I overspent $300. I called my mom. I said, I need $300. I got to pay off a credit card. She goes, a what? You have a credit card? I said, yeah, I got a credit card. She goes, I'm not giving you $300 to pay off the credit card. I called my friend's dad, Michael Kasten, and I was like, excuse me, Mr. Kasten, I know you don't know me that well, but can I borrow $300 to pay off this credit card?
Oh my
God. And he gave it to me. Yeah, he gave it to me.
Did
and then that summer, I paid him back. Yeah, I paid him back that summer.
Oh, man. He's probably telling everybody, what kind of parents does he have?
Right, yeah.
Boy, yo.
Kurt Russell, what an asshole.
No, but listen. On the flip side of that story is one day there's a knock at my door my sophomore year, and there's a fucking chef standing at the door with a casserole. I'm like, hi, can I help you? He goes, are you Oliver? I said, yes. your mom hired me to cook for you. And I'm like, are you shitting me right now? All of my roommates are like, your mom hired a chef to cook for you. So now I've got this food coming in every week. I was mortified. I couldn't believe she did it. I called her up. I'm like, mom, why are you calling a chef? This is horrible. Everyone is like laughing at me. They have a chef in college, but you won't pay off my credit card bill.
Right. How much would you kill for that chef right now, you fat bastard?
Hey, I'm jealous right now. I wish I had a chef.
I know. Hell yeah. Hey, Michael, does it feel different? This just dawned on me. With the way this country is right now, going in to read the news or be a part of the news or deliver it, does it feel heavier than it's ever felt in the years that you've, you know, been on television?
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing the news now for 6-7 years. It's definitely different. Definitely different. The difference, the subject matter, I think we do a lot more. When I first got there, I was talking to George, and George said, you know, after the presidential election, we may spend 3, 4, 5 minutes, if that, on politics during the show. Well, now, you know, we're spending 20 minutes at least. Like, everything is amplified, but it's heavy stuff because it especially now, it's been about, social justice. It's been about racial inequality. It's been about a lot of the racial things that have been kind of stoking fires around the country as well. It's been about presidential disagreements and all these different things that come up every day, and some of the things that are said that make you just shake your head. It's just every day it's something now. Mm-hmm. Nothing, it's never really an easy news day anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been the biggest difference. There were days where you could go in and I looked at the rundown, I got the notes, I've been reading up all night and this morning, no big deal. Today's going to be a light day. Now, whenever we do light things in the show, it actually almost feels more out of place. Whereas before, when we had to do heavy stuff all the time, that almost felt more out of place. So, but I do love the job because I think what it's done to me is made me more informed about the world. It's made me more informed about politics, maybe more informed about people and health and you name it. I mean, I'm just more informed and well-rounded as a person, but it definitely has taken on a totally different tone, completely different tone.
Yeah, I ask that because I wonder, you know, for somebody like you, who I don't know anybody who you have met, if we have mutual friends, that doesn't love you. And I feel like, do you sense that you are also in a position where you have to take a stand or take a side or have an opinion on a news story? Now, obviously, when you get into race relations and you're getting into racial inequalities, people are going to go to you for an opinion. But even politically now, I mean, everything kind of folds into that and where we are come November. Do you feel this odd pressure to, or maybe it's not odd, but at least a responsibility to weigh in that way?
That's a very good question, because there are so many stories. I can comment on anything. And one day I do say, maybe when I'm just at the certain point, I just want to do a show where I can say whatever I want to say about whatever I want to talk about.
Oh, I'm going to do a game like that. It's going to be a hell of a game. And then you'll never see me again.
Exactly. When I was like, always tell them, you guys going to be able to tell when it's my last day. Because I'm going to get out there and I'm going to light it up. But you always got, I mean, I have opinions, but I always have to tell myself, my job is to deliver the story. You listen to it and you form your own opinion. And it's no different than just being responsible when I'm out and about. I always say to myself, make sure you're reporting stories and you are not the story. That's always my focus, because if that's the case, I'm doing something wrong.
But does that even exist anymore? I mean, is there actually real news that is delivered like it was? I mean, it seems like everything is an opinion show nowadays, you know?
It seems like it, yeah. Yeah.
Is there any straight news anymore? I just don't know.
I don't know. I think when you watch the news, depends on what channel you watch, you can go, okay, they lean this way.
You know what you're going to get. If I go to CNN, I know what I'm going to get. If I go to Fox News, I know what I'm going to get. If I go to, you know, I mean, it's, there's destinations. If you want to get, you know, your opinion fed, go here. If you want to be pissed off, go there.
But how many people, Joe, will watch both? Most people stick with one and watch it and get just like, that's where I'm staying because that's what I don't want to get upset watching the other, because very few people can like sit back and just take in both opinions and kind of, you know, make their own decision. So that's, I think, right, in a lot of ways, watching television is in so many different ways, they push you wherever they want to push you. And like you said, you can watch and you can tell. But I think for me, as far as being like a on-air guy, my job is, oh, here's the story. This is what they produce. This is the story. I'm going to lead. Somebody else is going to tell it. And then you make your own opinion.
Yeah. And I led into that question because I do feel like you're a pleaser. I know I'm guilty of being a pleaser. You want people to like you. And I don't think that's there's anything bad in that. I'm the same way. And I feel like when you're doing the news, you know, now everybody is so ready to just fire off a tweet or Instagram something or whatever, that it's become more impossible than ever to just kind of live your life and avoid the muck.
But I told a friend of mine about Twitter, because they did something, and I said, hey, you gotta take that down. Just like, there's nothing good gonna come about that for you. And they were like, oh, you know, I said, hey, anytime that anyone's ever got in trouble, it's for Instagram or Twitter, it's when you tweet or do an Instagram post when you're emotional. Mm-hmm. People don't know how to sit back, take a breath, think it over, make sure that's what you want to put out there. Because once you put it out there, you can't. I hate when someone puts something out there, then they get, then some people give them a hard time, then they remove it. It's too late. It's never gone. Mm-hmm, somebody already screenshot it one second after you posted it. So, dude, it's over. Just think about and be rational about what you post, and never, ever post anything when you're emotional. And we all are emotional. We all get fired up about certain things. I mean, I a lot of things that get me going, but I'm going to share them with people who are right in my face and not post it for the world to see, because a lot of things, basically, until my last show, aren't anybody else's business.
Do your kids watch you?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Depends on who you're interviewing.
Do they have
opinions? Then you're cool. Right?
Yeah. If it's some kid from some TikTok or some makeup
they're all
tutorial,
in. Dad's cool.
Then Dad, I can't believe you met him and oh my or her and oh I can't believe that you didn't tell me they were on. I'm going, I didn't know you cared, first of all. Like football is like, oh, Dad's doing a football thing. They don't really pay attention to that. The news, they only pay attention, like I said, are interviews when it's somebody who is in their world that I probably don't really know, but I got to interview them anyway. And they watch the $100,000 Pyramid. They watch that because it's a fun show.
Oh, yeah.
And,
I did that
but
with
other
you.
Than, yeah, you did it, man. You were fantastic, by the way.
Hey,
but
thanks.
Joe, you got to do it.
I'm not, unless I'm hosting it, I'm not doing it. I'm
Why?
Not good
what
at
mean?
That shit because I need
you
to
do
know the
everything.
Answers.
You don't say
I just,
no
I'm
to
not
anything,
good. I'm
Joe.
Not good under the gun like that. I'll suck. I just won't be good.
Joe,
I don't like being bad.
You come on.
Get me
come
on.
You,
get me on. I'll do it.
Joe, don't say that because I'll get you on.
I'll do it in 2 seconds.
Hey,
we're going to start shooting this sucker soon.
I'll go on with you.
Yes.
We can do it together.
Yes. All right, good.
Ooh.
Yes, please.
I want to ask real quick about your kids and when you were playing football and how you were able to sort of balance that, because you're on the road so much. Yeah. And how are you being a dad, you know, during that time?
Well, football was tough in the sense that, but it's also of all the sports, probably the easiest one, because we leave on a Friday latest, and then we come back on Sunday.
Yeah.
So you're basically gone for a weekend. But I think the biggest struggle is balancing the work and getting home, and can't say I'm tired. You can't say, oh, I had a long day. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me to have twins, and at that point I was divorced. So I'm sitting there with 2 year old, 2 years old, from ever since they were 4 months on up by myself, looking
single dad, first, right?
As single dad, especially at first, going, what the hell do I do with 4 month-old girls?
Yeah.
You know, I got to figure it out real quick. And but you, the time, I read some book that said the time you spend with your dad for your children over the first 3 years of your life could is probably the most important time. And I think as fathers, we get into the notion that when the kid is born, the baby's born, mama just needs to take care of the baby, and mama needs to feed the baby, and mama needs to I'll change the diaper every once in a while. I'll come in the room and look at him, but nothing I can do.
God, and that, not me. I am so on the opposite plan of that. I can't get away with that.
Yeah, because your wife is up your ass about it.
That's right.
But then, man, I the 3 years, when the first 3 years, I expect like die everything. And then to this day, like my relationship with my kids is fantastic because of it. And I think it's because of that time when they couldn't speak and they couldn't do anything, but they knew I was there taking care of them by myself, hustling, you know, trying not to, they're just playing in the living room and I'm trying not to fall over and fall asleep on them, you know? But it was tough, especially being a single dad, but it was worth every second of it. And now, I mean, it's fantastic, man. Payoff is when they get older, for sure.
It's just hard, man. That must be difficult being
just
a single
physically.
Dad. Physically.
Yeah.
And even just emotionally, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm playing football. I'm doing what I love. I'm making a life for myself and my family. Mm-hmm. But I still have to be a parent. And it's a testament to you, too, to actually stay up with them and play with them when you're exhausted. But
that's what people don't think, though. They think that, you know, if you're an athlete or if you're on TV like we all are, in movies like you are, Oliver, that, you know, life is, first of all, they think life is a lot different from what their life is, especially when it comes to their family. If because you do these things that put you in the spotlight, that you just have a beacon of light on you every day as you walk around the world, if you walk on water. And that's not the case. We go home, and I know I do, to the same problems and issues as everyone else. And now being a father with, you know, a 28-year-old, a 25-year-old, and twin almost 16-year-old girls, who I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop on the boys. You know, I'm getting ready to – I said if boy takes on them on a date or either one of them and they show up at the door, I'm going to have on full uniform, eye black on, helmet buckled.
Do the Oklahoma drill with them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're going to have to earn that date, buddy. You're going to earn it.
All right. We have 1 minute with you, and then you're getting off because you're not going to be late for your Fox call with Bill Richards. I'm smarter than that. But our producer, Sim, is a Giants fan, and he just wanted to come on here, and for 45 seconds, he's going to tell you how much he loves you and the
yes,
New York Giants.
And then I got one last question.
Hey, what's up, Sim?
I mean, hi, how are you? It's just an honor to meet you. I'm from New York. I've been such a fan. I mean, I'm not going to do this, but I'm gushing right now. I adore you. Thank you for being an inspiration to everyone, and thank you for everything that you do. And this has just been a dream. So thank you so much.
Hey, Sim. Hey, thank you. I appreciate it, man. And you know what? Being a Giants fan, you deserve more than working with these two. But you just hang in there. Better thing to come in the future. And I said that because I know they're going to give you a hard time when we get off this call.
God. So.
Danny Dimes. I love Danny Dimes.
Oh, God. Shut up. All right. Get off.
Danny Dimes. G-Man, baby. G-Man.
Go ahead, Oliver. Ask your last question.
My last question is, when you look back at your father and you think of the things that you have taken from him, you know, what is one thing that you are so grateful that you have, you know, that you have sort of inherited from him? And what is one thing that you wish you didn't take from him?
Oh, all right. I think the one thing that I am glad I have from my father is the attitude that he had. My dad always said when, not if. So it was all about when something got to happen, not if, because if breeds doubt. So that attitude that kind of makes me feel like if I really want something bad enough, I can figure out a way to make it work and happen. So it's a matter of when and just the positivity of that. So his attitude and work ethic. The one thing that I have that I wish I did not have for my father could probably be something that ties into the other stuff, kind of being stubborn and bullheaded and just thinking that, okay, I'll just work until it happens, when probably sometimes you may not need to continue to work. You got to, you know, say, okay, enough is enough. Be smart about it. But I think just his work ethic and his attitude, and then at the same time being kind of bullheaded about everything.
And you see a lot of you see a lot of your dad in you?
I see him. Everybody and their brother wants to call me right now. I see a lot. Yeah, I see too much of my dad in me at some time. At times. And to the point, I mean, I love my dad to death. My dad's an amazing man, 82 years old, trying to hang in there. I see he's slowing down, though, so that kind of freaks me out a little bit. But yeah, you ever like drink a certain way or walk a certain way or think or say a phrase? You say a phrase and you're like, oh, don't ever do that again. That's too much like your father. Like, too much of that for me.
I don't know anybody that deserves a vacation more than you. Thanks for spending time with us during yours. And
thank you so much. We appreciate it, man.
I hope I see you soon. I miss you. And let's hopefully get back to work and play a full season.
Well, yeah, hopefully we have some football, fellas. Hopefully we have some football.
I hope so.
I appreciate y'all having me, man.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Anytime.
Thanks, Michael. All right, brother.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye.
Take care,
fellas.
Have you ever seen anybody do a better job post athletic career than him? I'm trying to think, and maybe the only comparison, and it stops well before a certain event happened, was OJ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
OJ was Monday Night Football, acting in big movies, acting in television, beloved, and then we know how that story ends. But I mean, Michael is just genuinely one of the best, smartest, most open people I know. That guy does everything.
So charming too, man.
Yeah.
He's just so charming. What a guy. What a dad, you know? I mean, it's just, I didn't even realize that he was a single dad for that long. You know, I wanted to get even deeper into that, because we don't see that a lot. We don't talk to a lot of single dads, you know, who had to sort of manage a career. And he easily could have just probably said, you know what? I have my career, I have a nanny, and I'll just deal with my kids once my career's over. But that's not who he was. He was all hands on deck. You know, it's admirable. You can tell, though. You can see. You can feel it in him.
But it's not unlike what you talk about all the time, which is why we do the podcast, of kind of breaking the cycle. I think for him, he wanted to continue the cycle because he obviously has great parents. Mm-hmm. He obviously had a dad that was invested, working out with him every day for, you know, 4 years and building him up in those teen years to become who he was, really setting himself up. But he's continuing the cycle. He saw it. He saw a good version of it, and he wanted to be that himself. And that's kind of what I saw from my mom, who's in the other room right now. And that's how I learned how to parent, from my mom.
Yeah.
And I was all in, and I, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. And that's how you are, because as you've said before, you wanted to break the cycle of, you know, what you saw as a kid.
Yeah. I guess the goal is, you know, you want your kids to grow up and want to be like you, you know, I mean, for me, that's it. If my kids can look at the way that I do things and think to themselves, you know, I want to be like my dad. I mean, you win right there, you know.
There's no better compliment. There just is no better compliment to what you've done as a parent, which is not easy, and it's hard work. And it's like Michael said, he was tired, getting knocked around, running, just exhausted, coming home, but he wanted to put that time in. And that's how I always felt, traveling, doing a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when your kids are little, they don't care that you did the Super Bowl last night. You got to get up and be with them. And I wanted to get up and be with them.
Yeah.
It is not easy at times for anybody listening to this.
We always ask the question, you know, the last question I ask of what did you take from your dad that you loved, and what did you take from him that you don't really love so much? What do you think your girls would say about you if they were to be asked that question?
I think they, because I really honestly believe, right or wrong, that if you ask them, and I wasn't sitting there, and we really want to do an episode where that is the case. I interview your three, you interview my two older ones. Mm-hmm. They would tell you that what they're scared for me is kind of what you're scared about with me. And that is my stress. Like my, mm-hmm. I'm wound too tight. And,
but did they adopt that from you? Do they have that side of you that they don't like about themselves?
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah. I think they're both worriers. They're both the older one, Natalie, more so, I think, than Trudy. Trudy can put things in its place. Natalie really carries it around like I do. Mm-hmm. And I think they would tell you that they know that I poured everything I had into them, and it'd be sense of humor. That's what they carried on. We got on this call talking about that. And I think it's the best thing you can develop in your kids is a sense of humor, because it gets played out so many different ways. It's not just being lively or entertaining to friends or at a party or whatever, but you can also look at situations and see the funny side of it, even if it's not that funny.
Oh, it's the great diffuser. Sense of humor is the great diffuser, you know? I mean, but it can also be a crutch. You know, a lot of times I was using sense of humor to sort of hide certain things that I felt about myself. You know, I would be self-deprecating, not with full confidence. It would be self-deprecation because I actually didn't like that
it
part about myself.
And it was
defense, exactly. Yeah.
We've interviewed a couple people who I won't name on this podcast of the however many we've done, 20, I don't know, or thereabouts, that I see that they've had some hurt and they default to being funny. Or a line here to kind of really not answer the question or really get to the heart of the matter and really. So I see that. And I see that with you, which is why your reaction when Eddie Vedder was talking about all these this weird cosmic happenstance, better understanding of his own father after his father had passed away, hit you so hard. And, you know, that was really a window to a different side of you that I've never seen. And I'm glad I saw it, but you weren't in a position where you could do your defense.
Yeah, no, I know. I was defenseless.
Yeah, and but it was good.
No, it was good. It was good. It was good.
Yeah. I mean, my older one, I'll say this, when I remember we're sitting with my ex-wife, obviously, my daughter was little and she was probably in fourth grade. And when she, I mean, she's a beautiful girl, but she had ears that just stuck out. And I remember being at the dinner table and we used to do the highs and lows of each day. And so if ever we were together, you know, what was your high? What was your low? We took that from another family that we saw them do. So we started doing it ourselves. And her high was whatever it was, and her low, she's like, yeah, I mean, you know, a bunch of kids called me Dumbo at school and they made fun of my ears. I was like, really?
That's and what she's I called like, Kate, by the way. You know that. Like, I called Kate Dumbo all throughout her childhood.
No, she had I did not
ears
know that.
That stick way out. That's so
no.
funny. Okay, go, keep going. That's so funny.
But yeah. I said, well, what do you mean? They're making fun of you for your ears. And when you're a parent and you hear your kids being made fun of for anything, you're just like, you just want to kill. And she's like, yeah. I said, how long have they been doing that? And she said, oh, I don't know, the last 3 or 4 years. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, I mean, it's no big deal. And she was a little kid. She was probably third or fourth grade. And she wasn't saying it like, eh, I was so hurt. It was kind of, she was able to just laugh it off. And man, I was blown away by that, because if it was me, I would have come home sucking my thumb crying to my mom. And my mom would have busted some ass, by the way, the next day.
But isn't it funny, like that white hot anger that comes over you when you hear that someone is screwing with your kid? It makes me crazy. Like, I have to be locked in the room or I might go beat up a 7-year-old. You know what I mean? Like, I get that nutty about it. You know, if someone out here is making fun of my kid or I go crazy. Yeah. I cannot be rational in that
moment. I'm scared for my two-year-olds when they get older with the way the world is trending and me being even older than I am now with even less patience and saying the wrong thing or running into one of these parents. It's like, now we don't discipline her. Don't raise your voice to my kid.
Yeah.
Don't. Fuck you. I'm going to be 65 with kids that are 15 or whatever they are. And I am going to lose my shit because it's going to be like, oh, I'll tell your kid to shut the fuck up. But
I just had this situation. Now they're good friends of ours, so it wasn't really a big deal. And their daughter was way in the wrong. But we were at the beach and Rio is just running up with some seaweed, like all playing. And this daughter takes a big hunk of sand and just launches it in her face. And I was like, oh my fucking God. I mean, I tried to keep calm and realize, I was like, what are you doing? And she's like, it was an accident. I was like, that's bullshit. It was not an accident. Don't you fucking lie to me. And I was like losing it. She couldn't even believe I was this irate. And she like ran off into the parking lot or the beach. And I was like, oh God, now I got to go like apologize. And I went to try to apologize to her.
Wait, is this the other kid or Rio?
No, the other kid. Cause I got so angry at the other kid.
Yeah.
And I went to try to go to apologize in the parking lot. She's like running away from me, like going near PCH.
You're scary.
The highway. I'm like, stop. I'm not going to, you know, cause I lost it. Cause it was just a reaction. I couldn't help it coming out of my mouth. I was so angry.
I think as you get older, and my mom is about to turn 81. I'm saying that because I just don't want her to know that I just said that because she fancies herself a Midwestern Elizabeth Taylor. That the filter just keeps getting torn more and more down. So I just know that when I'm 65 and some kid is like running around crazy in an airport terminal, I'm going to have a tough time going, hey, get a hold of your fucking kid, you know, as he's running in and out of my legs or whatever it is. Or if, you know, God forbid, some kid gets into it with one of my boys, I'm just going to lose my mind and I'm going to end up in jail is what I'm saying. So keep this as my defense.
Yeah. Good. No, I know. Well, it's okay. We were protective. It's the way it is.
Yeah.
It's the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, this was fun, man.
God. All right. Goodbye.
All right. Goodbye.
I miss you and your Aspen life.